18, beginning to read at verse 16. Got up to leave, they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him." Then the Lord said, "The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If one of you will say to me, 'Then why does God still blame us? For who resists his will?' But who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, 'Why did you make me like this?' Does not the potter have the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common use? What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath, prepared for destruction? What if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory? Even us, whom he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, 'I will call them my people, who are not my people. And I will call her my loved one, who is not my loved one.' And it will happen in the very place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' they will be called sons of the living God."
Worship with our offering. My mouth and may the thoughts of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Our story this morning of Abraham is a difficult one, and I'm glad about that. I'm glad because difficult stories turn you around. They rotate your vision, they dislocate your expectations, they set you into tumbles and somersaults. And when they have finished with you, you're left wondering which way is up, but you're also left a little closer to God. It's a difficult story, this Abraham story, because it feels like a scene from a Near Eastern bazaar, with people haggling over the scene, the number of righteous, the number of wicked. This feels a little bit different from ordinary prayer. Conversation between humans and God, ought it not to be a little more pristine, and the fate of cities not reduced to the rhetoric of barter? It's not an easy story, so I thought that in a few moments we might read it again. But before that, three pieces of information. The first is that Genesis is a book which blends two portraits of God. Actually, they're the same portrait, but different aspects. The first portrait is of an awesome, powerful creator, and we would see that in Genesis chapter 1, in the creation of the world, when all that twinkles and foams and blazes and breathes is brought into existence in 6 days. And the second portrait is an intimate, close, personal portrait, and we'd see that in Genesis chapter 2, where God leads the animals to Adam and their names, and God breathes breath into Adam's nostrils, and God takes one of Adam's ribs and shapes it into a woman. Awesome, and intimate. Remember Genesis chapter 6 and the intimacy of God sharing boat plans with Noah. And remember the awesomeness of chapter 7 where water comes crashing from the heavens and roaring from the deep and the earth is flooded. Remember Genesis chapter 11, in the middle of this great human building project, the Tower of Babel, the awesome God comes down and scatters the people. And then remember the intimacy of Genesis chapter 12, where God speaks into the ear of a wandering Aramean and says, go, go to a place you don't know, away from a people you've grown up with. Awesome and intimate. The second piece of information is that our story today is a bridge story. It bridges between the promise to Abraham of Isaac and the destruction of Sodom. In between these two events is this conversation between Abraham and God. And we need the bridge, because without it, the story of Abraham being promised a son creates this picture of God who gives the gift of life. But beside it, we need to see God who brings death. And the Sodom story, it needs this bridge as well. Because without it, we would just see a mechanistic moment of justice. And we wouldn't understand the terms under which this destruction takes place. And because the righteous are never expected to look at destruction and shrug their shoulders, they are expected to ask questions. In the mouth of Abraham, we can ask our question of the destruction of Sodom. The third piece of data. Somebody has already tried to destroy Sodom before. It's in Genesis chapter 14. You can read the story when you go home. King Chedorlaomer ransacked Sodom in battle, and Abraham chased after him and got back the pillage and got back his nephew Lot. So when Abraham hears of the destruction of Sodom, I'm sure that in the back of his head he has this tyrant, King Chedorlaomer, and wonders what kind of being wants to destroy Sodom. So three pieces of information. The Genesis portrait of God is both intimate and awesome. Second, this is a bridge story which helps us understand the promise of Isaac and the destruction of Sodom. And thirdly, somebody called King Chedorlaomer has tried to destroy Sodom before. So let's listen to the story again. He went his way, and when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned home. There are two powerful ways that this story might arrest us and stop us and turn us around and leave us the better for it. The first is that it helps us understand God. And the second is that it helps us understand prayer. Our first issue, the role of God as a destroyer in the story of Sodom is not easy to live with. The portrait of God as intimate and loving is also not easy to live with, but we'll talk about that another Sunday. We don't find it easy to deal with the fact that God destroys. A few weeks ago, I was doing some research into how Amos, the book of Amos, gets used in Christian development agencies. So I asked two such agencies to let me see all of their Bible study material. And I expected in development agencies which talk about justice and social reform to talk quite a lot about Amos, because Amos speaks about these things. He says in chapter 5, let justice roll down like rivers, let righteousness come like an ever-flowing stream. Or he says in Amos chapter 8, he condemns the wicked who have cheated the poor with their unbalanced scales. So I was expecting to find lots of mentions of Amos. But there were very few. Particularly, it has to be said, in the Evangelical Development Agency. Yes, there were lots of quotations from parables in Luke's Gospel, and there were lots of quotations of John 10:10, I've come that they might have life in all its fullness. And there were lots of quotations from Micah 6, verse 8, what does the Lord require of you, that you act justly? But very little Amos. And I wondered, why is this? And I think the reason is because Amos, along with Nahum and Obadiah, are probably the three books in the Bible which are most dense with destruction. Amos chapter 5, verse 10. Just a few verses above that famous verse about justice flowing like rivers. Amos chapter 5. Alas for you who desire the day of the Lord. Why do you want the day of the Lord? It is darkness, not light. Or Amos 6, verse 9. If 10 people remain in a house, they will die. And the voice from inside that house will say, hush, we must not mention the name of the Lord. Amos, along with Nahum and Obadiah, are difficult, destructive prophets, and so we don't spend an awful lot of time with them. It's not just in the prophets, it's also in the Psalms. We would much rather sing Psalm 23, the Lord's my shepherd, I will not want, he leads me beside still waters. Much rather Psalm 23 than Psalm 53. God will scatter the bones of the ungodly. We'd much rather talk about the birth of Isaac than the destruction of Sodom. And so I think would Abraham. The story of Abraham talking to God is about Abraham dealing with his shock, with his horror. And he asks of God three questions. Questions which we might also ask. The first of these questions. Before I say this, by the way, I want to say a thing from Luther's commentary on this story from Genesis 18. This is Martin Luther's voice, it's not mine. There will be some of us in this church this Sunday who, in the week previous, will know all too much about destruction and about death and about pain. I do not know what kind of lives people have had. And if that is the case for you, then hear these words from Luther. There are those of us who have seen too much of death, too much of destruction. Let those who are struggling with death and are troubled by other perils hear Psalm 27, verse 14. Let your heart be comforted. Be of good courage. Wait for the Lord. If you've had a really tough week, then your verse is Psalm 27, 14. Let your heart be comforted. Be of good courage. Wait for the Lord. But for the rest of us, we have to carry on with Abraham's difficult question. Abraham's first question, shall the righteous be swept away with the wicked? I think this is distress about the indiscriminate nature of terror, that the fires of Sodom will be a weapon of mass destruction, that carnage will not take due process of judge and jury, that flames will be hurled down on those who don't deserve it. However, the evidence of the Bible is that Sodom was a wicked place and justice was done. In Genesis, the kinds of Sodom that are related are of sexual violence, in particular homosexual violence. In Isaiah and Jeremiah, the kinds of Sodom are named as injustice and false worship. In Ezekiel, the crime of Sodom is named as affluence without concern for the poor. And in 2 Peter 2, we are reminded that Sodom has twin towns and twin communities in today's world. Through my letterbox every month comes a magazine from Amnesty International telling us about the prisons and camps where the powerful elicit screams from the innocent. Let us not forget the way that banks and multinational corporations shut their ears to the poor and listen to the shareholding rich. Let us not fail to remember the excesses of our own hedonistic culture, where no limits are placed on the cravings of self and the needs of now. We can only shudder, for there are places like Sodom in today's world, where righteousness is in a very small minority. Abraham's second question is more of an outburst. Far be it from you, it's translated in most English translations, but in the Hebrew it actually means something closer to, that would be profane of you. I think this is a worry that there is something ungodlike, something profane, something unholy about the destruction of Sodom. To destroy Sodom would be like the blitzkrieg of King Chedorlaomer. God cannot be like this tyrant. Are I need that the destruction of Sodom might be that it would place God in profane company. What difference between the desolation of Sodom and the carnage of a suicide bomber, the tyranny of a warlord, or the scorched earth of rampaging armies? What difference between the fireballs of Sodom and the viciousness of the bully at school, the family member who draws attention to our failings, the boss who makes us squirm? Abraham's second question, would that not be profane, ungodlike, to destroy Sodom? Abraham's second question, like his first, shall the righteous die with the wicked, is not answered until he has asked his third question. If there are 50 righteous, will the city be spared for their sake? This is a question, I think, about the enthusiasm for destruction. I don't know if you read a few weeks ago, a few months ago, of an IT consultant called Tom Metcalf, who got up to speak at a political conference. I'll not say the name of the party. And he got up and he outlined his vision for a better Britain. He said, make prison a genuine punishment. Applause. Bring back solitary confinement, take away their snooker tables and TVs. More applause, more cheers. Tom began to warm to his theme. Bring back birching for young tearaways and bring back hanging. Applause, more applause and cheers. Now, there is a debate to be had about criminal justice, and there is a debate to be had about youth crime. But what made me uneasy about Tom Metcalf's speech was their enthusiasm for brutality. If Tom had done his research, he would know that harsh, overcrowded prisons have a reoffending rate of above 90%, whereas some community schemes which emphasise rehabilitation have reoffending rates of nearer 65%. Now, I'm not saying community service is appropriate for every prisoner, and I'm not saying that 65% reoffending rates are great. But what worried me was that Tom Metcalf didn't seem to have explored the other options. He was too keen to get the birching of young tearaways. Abraham's haggling with God, it's not really haggling. I think it's more a discovery. A discovery about the other options. Is the destruction of Sodom really the last resort? He asked about the 45, then the 30, then the 20, then the 10. Abraham is not persuading. There are passages like Moses in Exodus chapter 32 where a prophet does persuade God not to destroy. But this is not this kind of passage. Abraham is discovering instead two things. He's discovering firstly that God will destroy, but God is not a celestial Santa Claus where circumstances that demand justice are just swept under the carpet. But neither is God a cosmic Darth Vader who is eager to destroy. And Abraham asked his question. And when God says, even if there are 10, I'll not destroy, Abraham goes back home. And he knows that destruction won't be indiscriminate. And he knows that destruction won't be profane. And he knows that destruction won't be enthusiastic. And he goes back home. And 28 verses later, he stands over the fires of Sodom and he sees that the city has been destroyed. And he does not dance, and he does not laugh, and he does not smile. But he does, I think, understand. And if it's for our spiritual growth, then I think we have to stand with Abraham and look over the fires of Sodom. And that will help us grow. Why do I think that? Which event do you think was the event in the Old Testament that Jesus spoke about the most? Well, the event that Jesus spoke about the most was the giving of the law to Moses on Sinai. But the event in the Old Testament which Jesus spoke about the second most number of times, three times, was the destruction of Sodom. Now, there was no one who loved more than Jesus. There was no finer storyteller. There was no better dinner guest. There was nobody who had more compassion. And yet Jesus never forgot the fires of Sodom. and neither should we. Quickly, I want to say what this passage says about prayer. It says here that prayer is not always a transaction, getting from God what we want. It says that prayer is not petulant, full of demands which we won't back down from. It says prayer is full of boldness, perhaps 50, 45, 30, 20, 10. It says prayer is full of compassion. It says prayer is not mealy-mouthed, watery, dripping with insincerity, bored with mundane topics. It holds before God the things that really matter. Calvin says of these verses, "Whenever different temptations contend with our minds, and some appearance of contradiction presents itself in the works of God, only let our persuasion of God's justice remain fixed, and we shall be permitted to pour into his bosom the difficulties which torment us, in order that he may loosen the knot that we cannot untie." But I want to ask one final question. How does this deep, rich, earth-shattering, soul-changing prayer come about? It comes about when Abraham doesn't go with the men into Sodom. He decides to do something else. He decides not to do something, to go with the men. Prayer always happens. Deep prayer always happens when we decide not to do something else. Rich, humble, bold, tentative, daring, tearful, hopeful prayer always happens when we decide not to do something else. What something else are we not going to do this week so we can talk, truly talk with God in a dialogue where we discover that God is not King Kedar Laomer? A dialogue where we discover that God is God. Shall we stand to sing our last hymn, "Lord, for the Years"?